One of the topics that we start off with today is, you know, I'm not sure where you live, but there's always been a sort of a cachet about living on the water, near the water. You always pay more when you get on the water or near the water. Well, you know what? Research is showing that while, yeah, it's still kind of expensive to do it, the premium for being along the water, it's actually been falling. So I wanted to find out why that is and what that might mean for us. Joining me is Peter Jeffrey. He's the real estate editor at Bloomberg. He's an expert on this topic. And Peter, thanks for joining me on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hi, Paul.
How you doing? Hey, so am
good
I right?
Good to talk to you.
Yeah, same here. So it used to always be, at least when I was buying my first condos and whatever, if I wanted to go on the water, I needed to have a lot more money than if I wanted to live elsewhere. What has changed? And maybe it's changed since sort of the market crash in 2008, huh?
Well, the sad thing is you still have to have a lot of money to live on the water. But what we found is that the premium itself is shrinking. It was 41% above an ordinary house without waterfront features for 20 years, or 22 years since 1996, according to Zillow. And so Jeremy Hill, a reporter who looked into this, found from the Zillow report and other research that over the course of that time, the premium got as high as 54% in the second quarter of 2012, but now is down to 36% for the first quarter of this year. And the main reason seems to be that everything else is just so expensive. So when you look at the difference, it's not like you're paying, you know, a small amount of money for a waterfront home. It still commands a premium and a substantial one, but nothing like what it once did.
So when you think about why this happened or what's going on, again, it is still expensive to live along the water. But I think about, you know, the whole climate change issue, the hurricanes, they've been catastrophic, climate change issues. It just is that responsible for it's got to impact the value of waterfront homes.
Depending on where, and I think that it's got to play some role. In fact, when Jeremy spoke to an economist at Zillow, she told him that, you know, yes, some buyers might actually be a little bit wary now about which homes they consider in terms of waterfront property. And she said we could see a trickle-down effect of people getting more and more worried about rising sea level. So who knows what that could do to the premium?
So,
meaning that if you're in a waterfront home, you're an owner, and you're hoping to sell, one of the things you're probably looking at is what the climate folks, like the Union of Concerned Scientists, for example, in June put out a report estimating that if you look at homes across the country, that homes across the country with a total value of $118 billion are at increased risk of flooding over the next three decades. So if you're an owner of a waterfront home and have visions of selling it, you know, for a high price, you very well may be able to, but it's certainly a factor that some buyers are considering.
Well, Peter, what possibility is there that just over the years, over the decades, people's tastes have just changed? I mean, you know, maybe when in the early 80s, when I was looking to buy condos or mid 80s, you know, living on the water was spectacular. It still is. But could it be that tastes just change in time?
It's possible. You know, there was also a report from Zillow in June about a similar thing happening to premiums for vacation homes. So I suppose it's possible that people are hunkering down in the main homes that they buy and they love, and I guess it's possible that part of the reason is that it doesn't hold the same allure. But again, it's still a pretty substantial premium. And it's interesting because if you look at premiums by geography, well, for example, you look in your own hometown there of Chicago. I'm just looking at the list now as we speak. And again, the average premium that you pay for a waterfront home over others for the last 22 years has averaged out to about 40%. In Chicago, it's only 21%. And there are a number of factors involved. One of them is how big is the body of water? What Zillow found is that there's a very, very small river or small lake, then the chances are that the properties along that body of water, since they command a scarcity premium, will have a higher waterfront premium. Also, if you have a pocket of very valuable real estate that, compared to the rest of the metro, is just way up there, then naturally those waterfront homes, being within that pocket, will also command a high premium. But I thought it was interesting that the Chicago premium is down at 21%, well below not only the average since 1996 of 40%, but below what Zillow found in the first quarter of this year, which was 36%.
I'm so happy.
Well, you tell me. Tell me about the waterfront homes in your neighborhood there.
Yeah, well, that's the only waterfront homes we have in my particular neighborhood is when the streets flood. But I know what you're talking about. And so, you know, when you talked about a body of water, perhaps here, of course, the Chicago River. Now, to me, living along the Chicago River with that view is spectacular. Lake Michigan, which, you know, if people listening in from who haven't been to Chicago, they think of a lake as though you could see the other side of it. But people who come to Chicago for the first time look at Lake Michigan, they think it's an ocean because it's, of course, that vast. The other thing that seems to impact, I would think, value, you tell me if I'm wrong, but at least in Chicago, the closer you are to the downtown area, the premium is kicking in. The further north you go, because the water will take you all the way up, but you will have moments, pockets of areas where the pricing probably isn't as high, because it also probably isn't going to be high off the water as well.
Well, that's absolutely true. In fact, Zillow looked at a bunch of low-premium waterfront markets, including Cincinnati and Memphis, and they found that there, where most of the waterfront homes are located outside the city and require commuting for more than 3/4 of an hour, that puts a real downward pressure on premiums. Whereas if you're on the Chicago River, it's glorious. On the other hand, storm surges are a factor, too, in terms of wariness of buyers. I mean, it's not just oceanfront property. In Florida, for example, that people are a little bit concerned about global warming and the rise of the oceans, but storm surges inland can also play a role. Oh, hey, just one random fact to throw out there since we're talking about low-premium markets. The only one on the list that had a negative waterfront premium, in other words, the opposite of a premium, is poor old Pittsburgh, which is actually doing very nicely in many other respects. But it has a whole bunch of waterfront properties along the railroad tracks. And so it kind of brings that premium down into the negative territory.
All right. That means people from Pittsburgh are making their way to Chicago now where they can get better waterfront property. Peter Jeffrey, the real estate editor at Bloomberg. Thank you, sir. It was really interesting.
Oh, well,
topic.
Let me just correct you on that, Paul. I'm a real estate editor at Bloomberg.
You got it. A real estate editor extraordinaire, though. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome back to Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Paul Lisnick in for Steve Bertrand. It is 12:24. And if you follow the news at all, you know that the president has been stirring things up by imposing tariffs on a variety of countries, including Europe, including China, and many others. In addition, of course, if you're following the news, you know that Mayor Rahm Emanuel has just been in China, where he's trying to make some things happen. We thought it was a good time to check in on China and see how our relationships are going. Joining me is the Consul General of China to Chicago. Consul General Hong Lei is here in the studio with me, and good to see you. Ni hao.
Ni hao. How are you?
I am good. We'll do this in English, but I do honor you with some Chinese phrases that I know. So look, let's start with the tariffs. This is big news. And a lot of other countries, even at NATO, do believe that we have to put some kind of check on pricing with China. What is, as Consul General, what is China's reaction here to the tariffs being imposed? Because there's more to come.
We think this kind of decision by the U.S. government harm the interests of China and also harm the interests of the whole world. And it harms the interests of U.S. people. Because with this kind of decision, it raise the cost of manufacturers, it increase the prices of U.S. products, and it actually hurts the interests of the consumers. So what it brings, actually, it is a very disruptive influence to the Chinese economy, to the U.S. economy, as well as to the world economy. So we think this kind of unilateral and the protectionism approach is very much detrimental to U.S.-China common interests, and it's also harmed the interests of the whole world. So we are firmly against it. So China, in order to protect our legitimate rights and interests as well as our dignity, the trading system of the multilateral trading system of the whole world, we have to strive back.
So as these relationships continue, do you see any movement in the Chinese government? Obviously, the president wants a change, and he wants to see, in his version, fairer trade. Is there any way China will, could step up, because obviously the president has a very good relationship with the president of China, president of the United States does. Do you see any working between them where they can attempt to work things out, or there's also another $200 billion in tariffs ready to go on board soon? Do you see the tariffs continuing, although I know you don't favor them?
Actually, China has been showing our sincerity in addressing the relevant concerns from the U.S. side for quite a long time. We have our vice premier visited the United States in the last 4 months for two times, discussing with the U.S. government officials how to address the trading balance as well as the concerns from the U.S. side for intellectual property rights, 2025 strategy, that is for China's manufacturing upgrading, as well as the so-called forced transfer of technology issues. From Chinese side, we believe that United States and China, we have huge common interests. Now we are the largest trading partner each other. Our two-way investment stock reached $400 billion, and it is very much important for our two countries to create even better condition and formulate even reasonable policies to facilitate this kind of gigantic economic interaction. So we should avoid this kind of trade conflict between our two sides. Yes, unfortunately, the U.S. government rescinded the agreement reached between our two countries and go forward to impose this kind of punitive tariffs on Chinese side. It is really something we don't want to see.
It's a very complex relationship between the United States and China, I think on many levels. And one of the other pieces that you're familiar with is the work of ZTE and the president saying, yes, we need to assist China in enhancing jobs there and having that company do work here. You have a lot of members of Congress, almost universally, who don't trust that particular company. So we have the technological questions about trust between our countries, and at the same time, we have these tariffs issues. Did those issues work together? How important is trust when it comes to things, companies like ZTE, and whether or not we assist? How do we work through those trust issues?
Actually, China is a country which United States could trust. For the trade imbalance issue, we have the sincerity to reduce this kind of imbalance. So we have been advocating that China could import more goods from the United States, including natural gas and agri products. For intellectual property rights, China is nowadays an innovative country. So we are attaching great importance to protect the legitimate rights of foreign companies having their presence in China. And we also are calling upon our domestic companies to be more innovative. So intellectual property rights protection is also a very important issue for our domestic companies. So China's intellectual property rights protection situation is improving a lot in the last 4 decades. We have set up a system for beefing up all the protection for intellectual property rights, both for the foreign companies and the domestic companies. And there is no thing like forced transfer of technology. Never there is a request like that from Chinese government to foreign companies. And if you encounter this kind of situation, you could appeal to the Chinese government.
All right. Consul General Hong Lei, thank you so much for your time, for your insight. I appreciate it. Xiexie, on behalf of all of us, you're listening to 720 WGN.
Thank you.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Paul Lisnick from WGN-TV sitting in for Steve Bertrand. Okay, I love technology, and I know you all love technology, and you can't just go a minute without seeing something new, something exciting, and it relates to everything. The phones we have, the world of news, fake news, there's stuff going on now that's related to all of that. Let's talk about it. Joining me is Ian Schur. He's the executive editor at CNET, and he is on top of everything new in the tech world. Ian, welcome. Good to talk to you.
Hi, how are you doing?
I am great. So I want to start with this update to the iPhone, because people that have iPhones are getting this note saying, hey, we're ready to update you now. We got this bug fix, but you happen to know it is a lot more than that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Apple has been pushing really hard on the idea of privacy lately. You may have seen them kind of make a point about how Google and Facebook track you, but they don't. And so one thing that they just did recently with this update called 11.4.1, which is not a very sexy name, but what it does is that it actually restricts the ability for cops and law enforcement to hack into your phone if you get arrested or your phone's taken from you at the border. And it's a really fascinating idea. The way it works basically is that if you haven't unlocked your phone in an hour, you can't plug anything in that's going to pull data from it. So cops, usually they will plug in a little USB cord and then connect it to a computer or a hacking box that they bought to download all of your data. And basically, Apple's trying to stop that. It's interesting. You know, we'll see whether or not the law enforcement community pushes back. You may remember in the past, Apple refused to help the FBI hack into a terrorist's iPhone because they said by hacking in, they were creating a vulnerability that then could allow the government to hack into any of our phones. And so it'll be interesting to see if the government says, you know what, this is not okay. We want you to undo it.
Well, as I was reading about this change, questions also came up about whether phone chargers would still work. In other words, all the other consequences that get impacted by this change. So what should we expect?
It shouldn't really affect much of that stuff. We haven't heard anything. It's been out now for a couple of days, and there's been no indications that those concerns actually played out. And also, typically, Apple's pretty careful about those things, but it was something people were worried about. And also, the other question is this foolproof, right? Will this keep the government out, or will they find a new way for investigators and, you know, anti-terrorist task force to be able to hack into all of our phones if they need to?
All right. I want to switch topics here and talk a little bit about, you know, this omnipresent notion of fake news and what's real news and what's fake news. And, you know, working in the news industry, it's a very frustrating thing for me, probably for you, when real news gets attacked as being fake. How do you know what's real anymore? Well, one of the things you've noticed is that YouTube is actually spending quite a bit of money to the tune of $25 million to go after what they're calling fake news. What's that all about?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. What they're doing is they're actually trying to support popular creators that are on Google, on YouTube, to really help to deal with these issues. And they're revamping the way that news is even handled on their website. So for now, if you went to YouTube, let's say there was a massive news event, and you went to YouTube right at that moment, let's say there's a natural disaster, and you typed in, you know, that natural disaster, like Hawaii, then suddenly you would get a bunch of videos that people posted, and oftentimes they don't know anything, right? The news reports are still coming out. And so Google is revamping the way that they do these things. They're going to make it so that news that's trusted from local authorities or from national publications are going to get kind of referenced inside YouTube before there's time for videos to come up. And then the other thing they're going to do is start supporting people who they know are not spreading propaganda and lies and actually giving them money to help support their efforts. We'll see whether this turns into anything. You know, every time YouTube or Facebook or Twitter has made these kind of moves, people who are on the extreme and left criticize them, saying that they are, you know, cuddling up to the mainstream media and that they are shoving out these independent voices. And then, of course, those of us are kind of wary of it as well, because they're picking and choosing winners. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, you mentioned Twitter, and of course, that was yesterday's news, the notion that Twitter was stepping in and also trying to identify fake news sources or other components. And basically, people were going to lose their Twitter followers. You have lots of them, that might impact you more than somebody that maybe does not. But so really what this is saying, Ian, is that we have to trust YouTube executives and Facebook executives and Twitter executives, that they're supposed to know where the fake news, where the real news, who the real entities are. We actually have to trust their determination of all this.
It's actually worse than that. As we've written on CNET many times, these people are relying on computer programs that they write. And so they're not going through the trouble of, you know, suddenly there's a major disaster and they go to their computers and try to look for the news they think is right and wrong. They are relying on computer programs that they create and then train to look for those news sources that they believe are trustworthy. So it's a very weird situation. And this is the reality of technology in the modern age, is that propagandists and, you know, people who basically create fake stories and false news have found ways to actually game the system and look like they're legitimate and win with these computer programs. And that's what caused all these problems in the first place. So it's very hard to undo a lot of that damage and get people to trust all this stuff again.
I don't mean to ask you this as a political question, but obviously the president put such a focus on these issues, fake news and all of that. I'm just curious, was this all in existence prior to our current uber focus on this issue? Was mm-hmm. it were things just as bad prior to, you know, 2016 and all that? Was the fake news situation always right. around, but now it's highlighted?
Well, the quote, fake news, you know, that term wasn't around as much. But yes, this problem has been around forever. I mean, if you go to Eastern Europe, it's been a problem for decades. And what has happened is that in the United States, we didn't deal with as much of it until the 2016 election. And even now, a lot of experts who are in other countries say that we have it far better than most other countries. This issue that we deal with, it's bad. Don't get me wrong. But it is still pervasive around the world, and it's something that everyone is dealing with. I'll give you another example. Uganda, right, the in Africa, they just instituted a new law, tax social media usage. Imagine this, actually being taxed just to use Facebook in an effort to create and pay for programs that are going to fight false news in their country. So it's a problem that's existing everywhere, and everyone's coming up with different ways to deal with it.
Fascinating stuff. Let's turn to Netflix. Very popular website, and obviously a source for, I think they've changed the world in many ways, one of the first out there to do it. Well, there's now this question about what are being called smart downloads. That's what Netflix is going to refer to them as. I guess they were a little hesitant to have people download content, but as things have developed and things like Amazon Prime have come on into the world, Netflix doesn't see much of an option.
Yeah, so this idea is, to ensure that people aren't stealing shows, essentially, Netflix has resisted for a very long time this idea of downloading video. And it's not just Netflix. You know, the people who make this stuff, right, Universal, CBS, my parent company, all sorts of other companies, have always been a little hesitant to deal with the idea of people downloading restricted video, right? Especially when you're paying a subscription, you don't own the video, and you might try and steal it when you leave the subscription, if you turn off your Netflix account, for example. So now Netflix is starting to push a little heavier into this. They're going to offer this idea of smart downloads, which means that when you've been watching a show, let's say you've been watching The Great British Baking Show, which I've been enjoying recently, and you get to the end of one episode, it's going to automatically start downloading the next ones to your phone. So that way, if you are travel, plane, whatever, you'll have them automatically. You don't have to think about it, which is a really cool idea. But, you know, we'll see whether or not people actually like it. Of course, they have to deal with their phones only have so much storage and all those other things. But it shows that Netflix is trying to make things easier on people. And certainly when I'm on an airplane, I want to be as entertained as possible and not thinking about that I'm on an airplane.
I agree with you. So I was just watching David Letterman's new show. Now you've got me searching out The Great British Baking Show. I'm going to do that.
Oh, you should absolutely watch it. I will.
I will. We'll chat about it. Ian Schur, the executive editor at CNET. Thank you, man. I appreciate all those updates.
My pleasure.
All right. We're going to be back in just a moment. 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Hey, go grab your pocketbook, because I feel a sale coming on. The $1.9 billion valued Cars.com is taking the anticipatory steps with JP Morgan to potentially set themselves up for a buyout. Official details haven't been released by the company yet, but the trading floor can smell it as they reacted positively over the last couple days. We'll keep our eyes peeled for the next steps of the hopefully positive buyout. But in business, there's always a negative practice out there somewhere. And that's what class action lawsuit specialist Shannon Liss Reardon is trying to sniff out. Though she's a Boston-based lawyer, her latest case is taking her to the North Side, where dancers at the Admiral Theater, yes, that Admiral Theater, are suing the company over wages and the question, are they staffers or contractors? So if that's the case, where do tips fall into the mix? And how will this shake the industry? It's bound to have some sort of impact on the market because Liss Reardon is known for bringing legal battles to the gig economy, so this could be a larger change to not just the theater, but the world of contracting. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
All right, welcome back. Paul Lisnick from WGN-TV, hanging around for Steve Bertrand today. Look, I'm a baby boomer. I'm kind of the end of that era, and so I'm not thinking about retiring, but if I were, one thing is sort of upsetting. The notion is I might be ready to retire, but apparently my debt isn't going anywhere. Let's talk about that. Elise Glink is the publisher of ThinkGlink.com. She's the CEO of Best Money Moves, an HR app for businesses that helps employees measure their financial stress and then dial it down. How stressed should I be in terms of dialing it down if I'm a baby boomer today with my debt, Elise?
Depends how much debt you actually have. What's interesting about the baby boomers is that they've never met a debt they didn't like. And so what we've seen are record numbers of baby boomers entering retirement with brand new mortgage debt, 30 years worth, all kinds of credit card debt, student loans that they're paying for themselves, their children, and now even their grandchildren. And all that adds up to a pretty expensive retirement.
So was this a lack of planning throughout the career of the baby boomer, or was it just what we've been through? I mean, baby boomers lived through the 60s. They lived through the 70s. Turbulent times. How did we end up in this place?
Life is turbulent. I think that we arrived in this place through a couple of measures. One is we spend too much, just as a general baby boom generation. We want what we want when we want it, and a lot's been available to us. I think saving not quite as much as we could is always an issue, but I don't want to undercut how deeply hurting the Great Recession was to so many people who had to tap their incomes and their retirement accounts just to stay afloat during the very turbulent 7 to 10 years. We're just now coming out of it, but even still in Chicago, right? Incomes haven't quite kept up. Home values aren't back to where they were. And so people who had really tapped their 401ks are kind of struggling.
So if I'm a baby boomer listening in, I'm going, okay, great. You've explained to me how I got there, but you know what? Get me out of this.
Sure. So how do just we do go that? Play a lottery ticket right now. You'll be in good shape.
I thought that was the answer.
Yeah, it is. It's the answer for everybody. I think that the only thing you can do now is either work a few years longer, which, you know, with the demand in the marketplace for people who, you know, they need experienced people. They need people who are looking for jobs. Come back to the market if you haven't been in it. Find a job, stay at that job an extra few years. Try to push off taking your Social Security money as long as you can. And then finally, just save, save, save. It's time to cut back. You got to get serious about this.
Should I be nervous when I talk to like investment people? They're all millennials. I mean, I'm sitting here going, I've got whatever money
I have. You have nothing in common with them? They're your children's age? What's the problem?
Exactly. It's like, am I asking my kids to invest my money and take me to the right places? I mean, is training, is the insight different today amongst that generation? Or should I kind of hang with those folks who I worked with years ago?
I don't know. I don't think that millennials have any big answers above and beyond what everybody else has. I think that millennials, by and large, are looking to robo-investment advisories, which makes a whole lot of sense to me. If you're struggling, though, and are worried about not having enough money in retirement, investing isn't going to get you there. Because what happens if we have a downturn in another couple of years? You know, Wall Street Journal is talking about 2020 for a recession. So if you have a recession, you're going to see a downturn in the market beforehand. I would focus more on saving and a little less on the investing side. Even if you just did index funds, cheap to own, and cover the market, you'll be in better shape the more you save.
Well, you just said about it. Listen, a recession will come at some point. It's going to come. We don't know when.
We're overdue.
Yeah, exactly. So my question for you is this. Whenever you listen to financial experts like yourself, and we talk about that, where they always start is to say, well, you know, if you're 30 today, just ride it out. It's all going to turn around. And I get that. But we're talking about baby boomers in this segment. Baby boomers, with all due respect, I said I'm one of them, I don't think we have time to ride it out, do we?
Oh, I think we do. Typically people will live in the United States until they're in their mid-80s. So if you're in your 60s now, you've still got 20 years to go before actuarially speaking, end your life. And it could be that you're going to live a lot longer. So if you and I are both at the very last year of baby boom generation, beginning of Gen X, the likelihood is we're going to live till our late 80s. And so being in your, 50s or 60s today, when you've got 20, 25, maybe even 30 more years to go, it feels like you've got some time to work on the investments, but more, you got to save and you got to stay in the game, the job game, a little bit longer.
How do you play with the risk factor? Because the other piece that comes into this is the younger you are, the more risk you probably could take, should take. But when you're in your 60s, you don't want to take the risk in the investment side anymore.
You don't, but you want a balanced portfolio. And one of the biggest mistakes that people make is they underinvest in the stock market and they overinvest in bonds and then they just get killed on the returns. So don't do that.
Okay, that's good
Don't
advice.
Do that.
I brought my paperwork. Will you like take a look at it before we leave?
Oh, sure. No problem.
Elise Glink, publisher of ThinkGlink.com, CEO of Best Money Moves. I just got some great credentials here. That's an HR app for businesses that help employees measure their financial stress and dial it down. You've just helped me dial mine down.
So glad to hear it.